All right, it's a pleasure to be here to share with you the work that we've been doing at the Keck Telescope over the last 19 years. And this is work that I've done in collaboration with my collaborators, Mark Morris and Eric Becklin, and a whole host of current and former grad students and postdocs. This whole project was started with a question of, is there a black hole at the center of our galaxy? But today, there are other questions that drive this project forward, including the question of whether or not we can test Einstein's theory of general relativity, better understand the black hole's properties. Those are the physics questions. And then from an astronomy point of view, we'd like to understand how black holes grow, why is the accretion process so faint, and what is the role that black holes play in the formation and evolution of galaxies, as Marta set up so well. All of this work is possible because of tremendous advances that have been made over the last two decades in high-resolution imaging that allows us to see the center of the galaxy at infrared wavelengths at diffraction-limited resolution. This animation shows you what the center of the galaxy looks like as you go from seeing limited observations to diffraction-limited observations. Over this time scan period, we've gone from very simple techniques to very much more complicated techniques. So on the left, we see the speckle imaging approach, which was hardware simple, software not so simple. To the right, we have the hardware complicated and what we thought would be software simple, but of course is not. There's always more to be done. And in fact, driven by all that the fact that we see so much more with adaptive optics. In fact, any way that you can measure the quality of the image, it's at least a factor of 10 better, both in terms of your sensitivity, your ability to see fainter stars to reduce the confusion, as well as your astrometric precision, your ability to center your stars in your field of view. That being said, you're motivated to go back to your old data and pull out all that information. In other words, you have a decade of information there that is just dying to be pulled out. So in fact, our group spends a huge amount of time working on methodologies. This is just one recent example, which shows on the left what was in the animation, which is just the simplest approach that you could take, which is always our point of view, do something simple, get as much science as possible out, and then go back and work harder to get more science out. So on the right is the more sophisticated approach, which improves, again, what you can pull out, adding, doubling your time baseline, which is really valuable when you're measuring stellar orbits. The improvement in technology has also allowed us to move from a world of just images to a world in which we can measure both images and spectra. And of course, spectra are incredibly valuable. From the point of view of measuring, measuring the kinematics of orbits, we measure that third dimension of motion along our line of sight, which is really valuable, especially in this world where we're trying to get to the point of testing general relativity. And then from an astronomy perspective, you get to look at the astrophysical nature of the objects that you've been using as point particles. And of course, this has revealed many surprises over this the last 10 years. So let's start with treating all these sources as point masses to probe the central potential. This is an animation that actually shows just a quarter of the real estate that I was showing you in those looks at the animations of the data. This is a half arc second by a half arc second on the sky, and it shows how everything that, many of the things in this very small field of view move. So we track thousands of stars, and you're seeing about 10 in this animation. This animation has gotten much more complicated over the years, so there's a trail, there's a coding in the trails. A star is dashed when you've only seen it in images. It becomes solid when you've also seen it spectroscopically. So you can see many things. You can see the fact that our images get deeper, so you all of a sudden appear when they weren't known before. And then later on, as you introduce spectroscopy, which is also not as, you can't go as faint, you see those trailed. So you can also see that for some stars, we have complete phase coverage in the imaging domain, and others you only have partial coverage of. It also shows you at the end, I mean, hopefully you can see why SO2 is really our favorite star in this whole, in the whole business, because you have complete orbital phase coverage in images and almost the same for spectroscopy. Okay, so that means that SO2 is sort of the star of the show because it gives us the strongest evidence today that we have for not only the existence of supermassive black holes. So as Marta was pointing out, it was the active galactic nuclei that made us think about black holes in the first place, but now we have the opportunity in the center of the galaxy to come up with the best evidence for the existence of these really unusual objects. And SO2 also gives us the properties of the black hole at the center of our own galaxy. Our current best estimate for the mass from this particular star is 3.9 times 10 to the 6 solar masses, with roughly a 10% uncertainty. With the closest of approach of roughly 100 AU, this gives you a density of 10 to the 15th solar masses per cubic parsec. So this is 10,000 times higher in density, mass density, than any other galaxy. And what's probably more important is the lifetime for any other alternative, such as clusters of dark matter, is quite a bit shorter than the lifetime of the galaxy. On the left, we have the images. So this really shows you, as opposed to the animations, which are always cleaned up, the quality of the data. And you'll notice one thing in particular. The orbits don't appear to close. Today, this is completely consistent with our ability to control our reference frame. So in other words, one of our biggest foci today is understanding how we can improve our reference frame. On the left is the radial velocities, where you see that the radial velocities changed by several thousands of kilometers over the space of a few months. When we first started doing spectra, the quality was really lousy. So in fact, we didn't see a line, and it was only after closest approach that we could go back to the initial data and pull out that information. Okay, so you can see in this business, I like to say it's like a fine wine, it just gets better with time. And we do need to do better. As Demetrius is going to tell us later on, much of the work for the EHT is going to depend on our ability to measure the properties of the black hole's mass and distance from the stellar orbits. So the good news is, or the bad news is, the precision isn't as good as you'd like it today. The good news is that it just gets better with time. So on the left, we have, for SO2 alone, what it looks like today in terms of mass and R0, and you can see the correlation in the uncertainties. And then on the right, or in the middle, rather, is a simulation of what it should look like by 2019. 2019 is a particularly interesting date from the point of view of SO2, because SO2 will have just gone through its next closest approach, where we'll be a lot smarter in terms of how we make those measurements, because simply you know the orbital properties today, where we didn't know them 20 years ago. The other thing that helps you, in principle, is additional stars. So as you saw in that animation, SO2 wasn't the only one that closed. There are a few others that close. The challenge with those is twofold. Actually, primarily, the first problem is that they're fainter, which means that they suffer from source confusion in the imaging domain much more strongly than SO2. And of course, you don't get the radial velocities as easily, but you do measure them. It's just noisier. So you have to be very, very, I can't emphasize this enough, you have to be very careful with systematic effects. So while statistically you go from the dotted line on the left with SO2 to formally the solid lines in the middle, you have to guarantee to yourself that there are no biases. So I'm not sure I believe those small error bars today. This is something that you can overcome with both technology and methodology. We want to keep going through 2019 because, in fact, SO2 will go through its next closest approach, and this will introduce other tests of Einstein's theory of general relativity, which include the relativistic redshift, which is actually the easier thing for us to measure, and will be the focus of the 2018 measurements, and then in the longer term, the precession of the periaps, which is imaging domain measurement. But in both cases, you need to know the Keplerian orbital elements, which is both spectroscopic and an imaging measurement. On the top right, you have the difference in the radial velocities between the relativistic and the classical orbit, assuming that you know the classical orbit perfectly, and that's 200 kilometers per second at closest approach. And on the bottom is a simulation. If we just keep going, in other words, if we do nothing else to improve our ability to make the measurements or analyze the measurements, that in 2018, this should be roughly a Six Sigma effect. So we're excited by this, and as, again, Demetrius is probably going to tell you, this is where these kinds of tests from SO2's orbit fit in this diagram of all the tests of general relativity. Okay. So that's the first bit that I wanted to speak about in terms of our ability, where we are in our ability to measure the central potential. The second thing is the astrophysical pieces, which is what have we learned about the black hole environment. In this simulation, which shows us the orbits as we know them today in three dimensions, pulling back from the center to much larger distances so that we can actually see more clearly the kinematic structures, what we're coding here are what we know about the individual stars. So the young stars are blue-green, the old stars are orange-red, and the magenta things are the things that we don't quite know what they are. So there are many surprises that are embedded in this animation and many interesting kinematic structures, including the tendency for many of the young stars to reside in a disk. So there's so much that could be said about all of these interesting populations, because many of these observations are completely unexpected. To be clear about this, we didn't expect to see any young stars near the vicinity of a black hole. It's just, it's a region that's quite hostile to star formation, so you didn't expect to find any of them, never mind for them to be the dominant portion of the population that you observe. So that's mystery number one. Mystery number two is that you expect to see an abundance of old stars. In particular, you expect to see the cusp, and yet you see a dearth. You don't actually see the predicted cusp distribution. So that's mystery number two. And then mystery number three, which was introduced by Stefan Gillison, is this really unusual source G2, which is a source that appears to be tidally interacting. And so on the right here, we see a position velocity diagram from projection through the three-dimensional cube, which shows the bracket gamma, which shows this beautiful tidal interaction of this object as it approaches closest approach. Now let's see, what do we know about G2? G2 is a really a fascinating object. It's a very red. So it means that you don't see it at 2 microns, or at least if it's there, it's very, very faint. But it's quite bright at 3 microns. At 3 microns, this observation is absolutely easy. It's a very bright source. There's no subtlety in detecting it. So that's why it's red. It's an emission line object, so we see it in bracket gamma. Bracket gamma is a line that's roughly at 2 microns. So the continuum, as we said before, is extremely faint, but you see it in the line emission. So this is a collapse of the spectroscopic cube through the bracket line. It is, I have to emphasize this, this is the faintest object that's ever been reported at the center of the galaxy. This is a very, very difficult observation to make in a region which has a lot of gas that also emits at bracket gamma. Its basic structure is a core plus an extended low surface brightness emission. And it's in the low surface brightness and the core that you see this tidal interaction. This is an incredibly exciting object in the sense that it is tidally interacting with the black hole. And a lot has been discussed in recent years about what might happen as G2 goes through closest approach. So G2 went through closest approach this summer, and there's been a lot of discussion about what might happen at closest approach. And in particular, it's exciting because we would like to understand how Sag A star accretes. In particular, we'd love the opportunity to catch it in the act of experiencing an accretion event to see what the consequences of an increased accretion rate would be. So on the left is a simulation of G2. And on the right is just an animation showing you the near-infrared observations that show a highly, highly variable source. That is its natural state. So in fact, one of the challenges of studying this is understanding when you've seen something different. We had a little bit of fun with this last year. We collaborated with a professor in the finance department at UCLA who's an amateur astronomer and who pointed out that this business of being time variable is what you see in the stock market. So we used the financial tools to use timing information to develop a strict method for understanding whether or not Sagittarius star is in a different state, because you can't just wait to see it get brighter, because you don't know whether or not that brightness is just characteristic of its typical brightness. I can't emphasize this enough, that we already know Sagittarius star is a variable source. Okay, so that's entertaining and provides us with a tool for understanding whether or not Sagittarius star has reacted. The other thing that we've focused on in the last few years, or the last summer, is to study whether or not G2 has survived. And it, in fact, has survived its closest approach at 3 microns. So on the left, you see the 3-micron image. In the middle, it shows that it's absolutely compact. There's no evidence at 3 microns for an extension. All this tidal interaction has come from the bracket gamma emission. And on the right, you see the brightness. So for the last 10 years, at 3 microns, G2 has been constant brightness. A little inset shows you throughout this year. So it appears that G2 is not a simple gas cloud. And I would posit that G2 is most likely hosts a central star. So let's see what kind of star this is. Based on the near-infrared emission, you can model this as a black body. And if you do that, you have a black body that is 30 times the luminosity of the sun. These curves are just the evolutionary tracks through a luminosity radius diagram. So it looks like G2 would be consistent with a 2-solar-mass star, except that the black body size is about a factor of 100 times larger than one would expect from anything of that luminosity. So how do you get a 30-solar luminosity star to be that large? Well, one way you could do this is to merge a binary star. Binary stars, when they merge, they become much more inflated. In fact, there are many stars that are thought to be recent mergers that have the exact properties that we observe for G2 in terms of the inferred black body size and the luminosity. On the left is the predicted size, so tidal radius is a function of time, that's the line, and along with, in green, the black body size. The animation shows what we think is going on, so the blue curve is the tidal radius. And so as you approach the black hole, the tidal radius is shrinking. The red emission is what is the optically thick piece of G2. So when you hit closest approach, you've just hit the moment when the tidal radius for a 2-solar-mass star equals the black body size. In this picture, there is material that's being tidally stripped from the star, which is what you see in the bracket gamma emission. This is material that we think is being externally heated by the local mass of stars, whereas the 3-micron emission is being internally heated. Now, most stars in our galaxies are binary stars. And binary stars, when you put them near a third body, such as the black hole, are driven to merge through the Kozai-Lidov effect. So in fact, one might expect this kind of phenomena to be occurring at the center of the galaxy. G2, it turns out, is not unique at the center of the galaxy. There are other very red objects that appear to be experiencing similar sorts of interaction. What I'd like to focus on right now is an object known as G1. G1 was an extended red emission source that was first discovered when we first started taking infrared observations at the center of the galaxy. On the right shows you the orbital parameters for G1 and G2. G2 is blue, G1 is red. G1 actually has just passed closest approach. So in other words, G1 gives you insight to what happens long after closest approach. So closest approach for G1 is in 2001, which was 13 years ago. In the initial observation, it was extended, and then it's become quite compact. So in this picture, what's happening with G1 is its ratio of the tidal radius to the blackbody radius is much more extreme. In other words, you see the interaction more clearly. So the picture we have here, just to end, is the same sort of picture, except that the tidal radius goes within the object. And at 3 microns, you start to lose a more significant portion of the envelope. Okay. So in conclusion, the knowledge of the black hole properties are improving and will continue to improve with time. There are new tests of GR on the horizons, both from the EHT and from the stellar orbits. It's going to be interesting to see how these two approaches mutually support each other. And G2 is a fascinating object, and it may be a merged binary star. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you very much. I must say, when I entered Canada, the border control asked me about the binarity of G2. Luckily, I passed that test. I mean, otherwise, I probably would not have been able to get into the country. Anyway, so, Avery.
Hi, Andrea. I want to put you on the spot. We're looking at a future of next-generation telescopes, 30-meter telescopes, and even bigger. How well are we going to do with those? How well are we going to constrain masses and distances to the galactic center with the sort of observations you've talked about here with those?
OK, so you're asking me about next-generation telescopes, like the generation of the 30 EELT GMT business. So if you think that you don't hit systematic errors first, you're going to do tremendously well. So you're going to do much less than a percent in terms of distance to the center of the galaxy. But I would claim before one believes those statistical numbers, one should pay very close attention to your ability to control your systematic errors. Today we already see that our control over this variable point spread function, so the fact that the point spread function varies slightly across your field of view, is actually the reason why you don't see closed orbits today. So your ability to control for those effects, which you can, is going to drive your final uncertainty. That's not to say you should, it's all good, and you want to get closer. And in fact, in terms of the black hole properties, your ability to see things that have orbital periods of 3 years, which makes you much more sensitive to the precession of the periaps, is what's going to be opened up. Yeah.
Okay, Stefan?
In your prediction, where you predicted how well we can see the relativistic effects, you kept the orbital parameters fixed, so as if you knew.
No.
But then the differences cannot be 200 kilometers per second, I think.
Oh, sorry, that's what I said. Sorry, the simulation, the 200 kilometers per second, is, as I said, with respect to a known orbit. The simulation didn't assume you knew nothing. So your the bottom plot was allowing all your parameters to be free. Yeah.
Because I think that's what you need to do.
Of course.
Otherwise,
yeah.
It's much easier.
Oh yeah. If you didn't do this, this is an incredibly simple, as you know. Yeah.
Okay, Jonathan.
Yeah. Hi, Andrea. Kind of a basic question about the animations. A lot of them were purely dotted, meaning you don't have spectroscopic information. I thought you needed the radial velocities to get the inclinations, and spectroscopy would be needed for that. And the second part of the question, if you don't mind, is how does S16 stack up to S2 as a favorite?
Okay.
That's the closest approach one.
All right. So if you have two-dimensional information, you get the full three-dimensional orbit, except for the sign of the inclination with respect to this plane of the sky. And the way you can understand that is what you're using is conservation of angular momentum. So you can equal area and equal time. You just don't know if the orbit is projected this way or this way compared to the plane of the sky. So you can play kinematic games. You can play all sorts of interesting games with that. But this, obviously, you would like the spectroscopic information to pull out that last piece of information. It also gives you the distance. So those are the two things that get added, along with just another way of really nailing much more quickly the parameters down. What was your second question?
Okay.
Oh, SO16. Yeah. SO16 is definitely a piece of this, but I think something that we've all underestimated is something that the exoplanet community probably could have told us at the get-go, which is you have to be very careful with your orbits, your orbital determination, when you have inadequate phase coverage. Before you see both turning points, you can go very wrong. So you can get very precise but inaccurate answers. You could actually see that in our ability to tell when G2's closest approach was. So G2's first orbital parameters were published before even one turning point had been experienced, which just means that any mistake or any uncertainty, even if it's statistical, this is just orbital fitting biases, really drives your estimate of closest approach.
Okay.